From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Polls say Americans want it all. Rewarding, well-paying jobs, healthy, stable, and secure lives, material comforts, and adequate time for friends, family, and community. But we know for many of us, the reality is quite different. This hour, we discuss how we can do a better job of balancing our lives in this competitive new economy. Currently, the University of Iowa is hosting a three-day symposium that has brought together experts from government, academia, business, and the community to explore ways to make our lives more rewarding in a sustainable way. How to fix an unbalanced life. After this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We Americans want it all. Rewarding, well-paying jobs, healthy, stable, and secure lives, material comforts, and don't forget, adequate time for friends, family, and community. But we know for many of us, the reality is quite different, especially when economic times are bad. This hour, we discuss how we can do a better job of balancing our lives in this competitive new economy. Currently, the University of Iowa is hosting a three-day symposium that has brought together experts from government, from academia, business, and the community to explore ways to make our lives more rewarding in a sustainable way. It's called Balanced Lives, Best Policies for the New Economy. And joining us to discuss the symposium and how each of us can find the way to a more balanced life are a couple of people taking part in the symposium. In fact, they're on the site of this symposium at the University of Iowa as we speak. John DeGraff is joining us, Executive Director of Take Back Your Time. That's an organization challenging overwork and time poverty. Yes, that expression, time poverty, we'll explain that in a minute, in the United States and Canada. John DeGraff is the National Coordinator of Take Back Your Time Day, an annual event scheduled for just a few days from now, October 24th. He's a frequent speaker on issues of overwork and overconsumption in America, a documentary, award-winning documentary filmmaker as well. His new book, What's the Economy For Anyway, will be published next year. John DeGraff, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Also joining us, Dave Gould, a lecturer in the Health and Human Physiology Department and the academic coordinator of the Interdepartmental Studies Program at the University of Iowa. His courses explore the cultural importance of leisure and play. And in 2007, he won an award for outstanding teaching at the University of Iowa. This year, 2010, graduating seniors at the University of Iowa recognized him as one of the top faculty and staff members who has had a positive effect on their life. Dave Gould, welcome to our program as well.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me ask to start off, Dave, tell us more about the symposium. What is more on the nature of the problem that you're addressing with it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Ben. We had a conference here at the University of Iowa back in 1997. It was called Our Time Famine. And it came on the wave of several books and actually a film that John made called Running Out of Time, The Overworked American by Julia Chor, Work Without End by Ben Honeycutt here at the university. And basically what we attempted to do way back in 1997 was to bring a group of people together across disciplines that all cared about issues of time in our lives and the effect it has into our fulfillment and our happiness. Fast forward to 2010, and some of those same players are here on campus in Iowa City, gathered with others in the same disciplines and areas, talking now about how to move those issues and initiatives forward. And I mean, if you're looking at the arc of our 3 days together, Chris Honig, who is the CEO of the State of the USA, looking at how we can measure the quality of our lives. Here, this is a $70 million government initiative to look at how we can literally measure the quality and well-being of our lives. Today, we are actually looking at different models and looking at the struggles and problems that we're having. And then tomorrow, we will actually be participating. The information that will be gathered here at the university will be going to Chris Honig, the State of the USA, the National Academy of Science, and be used as information to establish those metrics.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about this, because this is an interesting aspect. Traditionally, GDP, gross domestic product, the index of a country's entire economic output, is a measure that governments at least use to measure whether things are getting better or worse when we talk about economic ups and downs. And the conventional feeling about GDP is that the more it grows, the better a country and its citizens are doing. So, John DeGraff, when we look at GDP, what does GDP really do? How well does it measure our quality of life? And then we'll get into what we're talking about when we are looking for this new measure.
Well, I would say GDP measures our quality of life modestly at best. It's got a lot of problems. In fact, many things that are important for our quality of life, volunteering in our community, having time, spending time with friends and family, exercising, these things don't count. They're a waste of time as far as the GDP is concerned. GDP measures basically the churn of money in the society, the total sales each year of the goods and services produced in the economy, their final market value. So if you get divorced, for example, that's actually a good thing for GDP because you've now got two households, you've got legal bills to pay. If you have a big oil spill like the Exxon Valdez or the oil spill in the Gulf, tremendous amount of money spent to clean it up and so forth. All of this adds to GDP, but it doesn't add to our well-being. Bobby Kennedy pointed out this about 42 years ago. So we're aiming to try to find some new indicators, and the little country of Bhutan in Asia has actually come up with one they call it gross national happiness instead. And this statement way back in 72 by the king of Bhutan, 16-year-old king, that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product, has spurred scientists from all over the world to start trying to figure out what does make us happy, how we can measure it, how we can survey it, and what kind of policies can lead us to a higher quality of life, not just a higher quantity of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris Honig was the name that was mentioned, the keynote speaker at your symposium yesterday, President, CEO, State of the USA, a former managing director at the U.S. General Accounting Office. Now, his task here is to come up with a new measurement. And how is he going about this task? What inputs does he have?
Giving us a new measurement. He's giving us a lot of possibilities from which we can make, if we choose to make it, a new measurement. There's about 200 to 300 indicators that will come out in this wonderful new key national indicator system, which he helped create and got into the healthcare bill. But from that, we will have to decide as a country, you know, maybe the 6 to 12 key things that we want, our values tell us are most important for us, and those are the kind of things that hopefully will begin to replace GDP as a way that the media and the way the rest of us look at how well we're doing.
Maybe this is a point we can reach out to our listeners during this hour and have our listeners provide input as to what would you measure the health and well-being of our country by? What indicators would you use? 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Dave Gould, what makes Iowa a good site for this symposium?
Well, you know, we have a long tradition in this. I mentioned the 1997 conference that we had that I think, from my understanding, was really the first that brought together this group of people to talk about this issue. We have every October, you mentioned the Take Back Your Time Day, the marking of that initiative that John has started that really looks at how Western Europe basically stops working on October 24th. I mean, it's a symbolic, obviously, but they stop working on October 24th, and that symbolically marks the date where we in the United States continue to work until the end of the year. We here at the University of Iowa have celebrated something. John has been on campus several times, Juliet Shore, around this time to bring awareness. And we have a leisure studies program here, which is something that unfortunately is not on all campuses across the country. And it's an issue that is very important to us in leisure studies to ask the questions about what is truly important in our lives.
So this October 24th date, if I'm understanding you correctly, if we in America, because we work so much more than the Western Europeans, if we in America stopped working on October 24th until the end of the year, we would have as much free time as the Europeans do every year.
Exactly. John, why don't you give a couple statistics for us?
That's right. And it comes from the numbers aren't always perfect, but it comes from the general idea that the European countries, at least when we started Take Back Your Time Day, were working 300 to 350 annual hours less, people in those countries, than Americans were working. And that translates into about 8-9 weeks. And so the end of October kind of marks that point. The other thing about October 24th is it is this Sunday, October 24th, is the 70th anniversary of the date in 1940 when we actually got the 40-hour work week in the United States through the Fair Labor Standards Act. So it has a second importance, and it's interesting to look back and say that despite the fact that, you know, we now produce 5-6 times as much per hour as we were in 1940, we still have a 40-hour work week. In fact, it's, for many people, it's getting longer. It's 50 hours and 60 hours a week, and this seems like something we ought to revisit.
And we've been hearing about the waves of thousands of protesters across France in the last few days, clashing with police. I think this is remarkable. Setting fires across the country, a demonstration of intense anger against government plans to raise the age for retirement benefits from 60 to 62. When here in the U.S., the current age for full retirement with Social Security benefits is, I believe, 67. So when we look at that, how did France and the U.S., and France is not that much different than the rest of Western Europe, how did we and the Europeans develop such different attitudes about the age at which a person can take it a little easier?
Well, I think we have. It's interesting that as recently as the early 1970s, Europeans worked a little longer than Americans did, but we've really diverged since that time. We have taken all of our gains in labor productivity in the form of stuff rather than time. They have chosen to take a lot of it in these longer vacations, in earlier retirement, and
why is that though, John?
Well, I think it has a lot of reasons. I mean, number one is that they still have a strong labor movement in Europe, and we've lost ours. And the labor movement traditionally fought for the idea of shorter hours as well as longer wages. I also think that, the attitudes and openness, here we have really, we really have an attitude that everything is kind of for business. If you put any kind of mandates on business, you're going to destroy the economy, all of these kind of things. The Europeans don't believe that. They believe that a market works best when it has a certain set of rules, ground rules, a floor of standards, for example. So it's the laws that have been passed in Europe that have made this possible. Some people say also that the higher taxes in Europe mean that, people who are working longer and longer don't keep as much of what they make, and so that encourages them to actually want to work fewer hours. And that may be true, but I actually think that's one of the best arguments for high taxes I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard to imagine? I find it hard to imagine people in the U.S. going out on the streets, hitting the barricades so that they can have more leisure time, which is essentially what's happening in France.
Well, I have find that hard to believe, too. And I think in France, some of these protests are really symbolic. It's not about the 2 years about retirement. It's the whole idea that there is a way of life based on leisure, on time, on rights for workers that they see as being threatened. And it may not be yet in Europe threatened, but I think that's how that's being perceived. I would argue that it's not a big deal if they move it to 62, and as long as they don't take away their vacations and other kinds of things. But I see them fighting this as a matter of principle. The same way Americans, in a sense, get out in the street and get all mad because they think we're going to raise taxes at all or have higher. It's a different philosophy of life. Our life is much more work-centered. It's much more money-centered, material-centered. Their life is centered on leisure and those long dinners and all of that, and the conference is about balance, and there's probably somewhere that we can find between the two to move toward. But I think we need to begin to move in that direction. Mm-hmm. Maybe they need to move a tiny ways in ours.
What about those who argue that moving in the direction that you suggest is giving up some of our economic advantage, our economic competitiveness in a global economy? We can't afford to do that, can we?
Well, there's no evidence that that having more time and things makes businesses or countries less competitive. In fact, the World Economic Forum shows that the United States is one of the most competitive countries in the world, but all the other countries that are right up with it are countries that have terrific policies around work-life balance. So, you know, some of the most competitive countries include countries like Finland and Sweden and Denmark and Finland, and the Netherlands, for example. And these are countries where there's great attention paid to work-life balance and very good policy. So there's no evidence. There's a good book called Raising the Global Floor out by Jody Heyman and Allison Earle at McGill University in Canada that just examines the different countries and says, you know, does it really make you less competitive if you have shorter hours? In fact, some businesses find it makes them more competitive because they actually have a healthier and happier workforce. What is making American business uncompetitive is the enormous cost we're paying for health care. And we're paying twice as much as any other industrial country, and we have the worst results. Okay. If we didn't work so much and weren't so stressed out, we probably could provide health care for everybody at less cost, and business would benefit in a big way.
John DeGraff, you've dovetailed right into the conversation I want to get into when we come back. Executive Director of Take Back Your Time, John DeGraff with us, Dave Gould with us, a lecturer in health and human physiology at the University of Iowa, talking about balanced lives. That's a symposium going on in the University of Iowa right now. And when we come back, we want to shrink this down also to the individual level to ask what constitutes a balanced life. Define a balanced life. When is a life out of balance? Perhaps you have a story to tell us of when your life was out of balance and how you got it back in balance. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, how well do you know the people who raised you? That's a central question in a new book by Michelle Norris, co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. It's called The Grace of Silence, and in writing it, Norris found herself unexpectedly confronting hard truths about her own family's racial history that had been left unsaid by her parents. Michelle Norris, tomorrow on this program, talking about evolving attitudes towards race in America. Today, we're talking about balanced lives. Do you lead a balanced life? Has your life ever been out of balance? What did you do about it when it was? How did you bring it back into balance? Tell us your story this hour, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Currently, the University of Iowa is hosting a three-day symposium that has brought together experts from government, academia, business, and the community to explore ways to make our lives more rewarding in a sustainable way. It's called Balanced Lives, Best Policies for the New Economy. Joining us, a couple of people taking part in it, John DeGraff, Executive Director of Take Back Your Time, an organization challenging overwork and something called time poverty in the United States and Canada. Dave Gould with us as well, a lecturer in the Health and Human Physiology Department at the University of Iowa. And I want to start off by picking up where we left off. Define a balanced life for me as you see it. A life in balance, a life out of balance. How do you know what kind of life you lead?
Well, I think, Ben, that to be honest, a balanced life is this kind of magical thing that maybe you get a glimpse of every now and then, but you struggle for every day. I think, like a lot of your listeners, I came to this whole field in a very unique way. 25 years ago, I came to the University of Iowa as a grad student, actually coming to get my MFA. Shortly after I arrived in town, we had a son, and then not too long after that, a daughter. And all of a sudden, on a relatively modest income, my wife and I struggled trying to care and spend time with the two kids that we deeply loved and wanted to be a part of, to keep the lights on in our house and electricity and all of those things, food in the refrigerators, and also to be part of our community, and then to do something we love to do in the marketplace, to kind of follow our dreams in the work world. And all of those things had a value to us, and when we began to see them begin to shift in one particular direction or another, when I felt my son or daughter were being neglected because of the obligations I had to my job, and And when I saw that my community participation, my civic engagement was being pulled back, that's really what drew me, quite honestly, into the field of leisure studies. I ask my students often to tell me what their goals are. And as you can imagine, they range across the board. But when you start continually asking the question, why? And you do that enough times, they all come to a central place, and that is to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly need enough money in our lives, and I'm not minimizing that at all. We need enough money in our lives to be sustaining. If you go to bed hungry and you worry and stress whether they're going to turn your lights off and send you out onto the streets, if I give you money, you will raise your happiness level. But at some point, when those needs are met, there is much more to life. And really to lead that balance is really to be following the things that you love to do, the things that are important to you, and obviously to be taking care of the things you need to do at the same time. And so this balanced life for me has been really a both a professional, but even more importantly, a personal struggle to try to arrive at that. It's a constant readjustment. It's a constant tweaking. It's a constant monitoring. But there's things that could be in place that could help all of us to do that.
Okay,
and that's the policies we're talking about.
Let's address that for an individual. People's listening, certain people listening certainly would say something like, well, I feel like I'm on a treadmill. I don't have a fulfilling job. I don't have enough time for my family, for my community. Where do you start? What steps can you take if you feel my life is out of balance?
Well, I mean, there's obviously two ways to crack this. One of the things we're going to be doing tomorrow is we're going to be talking about a certification, kind of like LEED is for the environmental kind of field, a certification, a work-life certification that would be at a business, for example, that would take into things like vacation time, would take into things like stress level, would take into sick time, would take those kind of mandatory overtime that people have to do at work. And this kind of a seal of approval, for example, can work to be a win-win in both regards. It's a signal to an employee that this is a good place for me to work. But I would also argue, when you go back to the business equation, it's a win-win because what the business world really needs right now is it needs creative minds. That's what we really need if you want to be moving your business forward. We know enough not to run our machinery 24/7. We know that burns it out. We know that has a negative impact at a point, but yet we for some reason or other forget that when it comes to our people. And so, you know, to begin to look and educate not only the public, to begin to look and demand those things in their job and ask and request those things in their job, but to also to have business see that it's a benefit, those are some places that we can start. So often people believe that there is no way out, that this is the culture we live in, and this is just the road we have to follow. But when we look at some of those models of the countries that John was talking about, we see that isn't the case, and that there are solutions. And again, if we can paint it as a win-win proposition for all concerned, then those are battles we can have victory over.
So what I hear you're saying is it starts at a macro level, governmental level, with organizations, businesses, and so forth, and also right down to the individual, working from the other end, the micro level and the macro level, trying to achieve a common aim.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, we want to reach out to our listeners once again. Has your life ever been out of balance? What did you do about it? What was the turning point? How did you bring it back into balance? Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're on Twitter at IPR Talk. And let's go to Ladora, where Brad is joining us. Hi, Brad. What do you make of this conversation? Has your life ever been out of balance?
Oh, absolutely. My fiance and I both were working in the corporate world for a number of years and chasing after that, you know, the almighty dollar, and just trying to eke out a living like most Americans. And we finally got to a point where we just realized it was insanity for us anyway, and both of us decided to leave our careers and chase a dream of opening a wine bar. And we did it in a very small Iowa County town. of Ledora, and we've never been happier. And now we've worked very hard, but we've also put limitations, kind of self-imposed limitations, as far as the hours that will be open, and we will even close for the month of January and half of February every year, because it's just we need to have balance as well.
Mm-hmm. And have you scaled back sort of your material consumption from
absolutely.
Those corporate days? That was part of the balance, wasn't it?
Well, it had to be, because it's really not about money at this point. We've been doing this now about 2.5 years. We're going into our third season, and it has been a struggle. The economy has been really a challenge for us. But what it boils down to is it was a lifestyle choice, and so we've cut back on numerous things. But we haven't found that we're missing anything by doing that. If anything, it's freed us up to really enjoy the simple pleasures of life, and just having our customers come through the door when we are open. We really enjoy serving them, and they enjoy being served. It's nice to see people with smiles on their faces. It's nice not having to go to corporate meetings at 6 a.m. on Monday mornings, because we choose not to.
Mm-hmm. Brad, what was the point you and your wife reached? Was there a moment, a point in which you said, we've had enough of this old life, have to take a risk? Describe that moment.
Well, that moment really was by necessity, because it was really affecting her health. There were physiology type situations. There were physical conditions that were manifesting based on the stress in her life as well as mine. And we decided, we've got to take care of our health. We've got to take care of ourselves. And this is no way to live. And we found ourselves at a point where we just had to do it. It wasn't like, well, we were taking a risk, or aren't they really brave people to do this? I didn't feel a sense of bravery. I felt more of a sense of desperation that we just can't go on, doing what we do every day, because mm-hmm. it was killing both of us.
Do you feel that in terms of health, the change has helped you tremendously with your health, you and your wife?
It's like day and night. It's like I don't want to say a magic pill, because it's still a challenge. We still have to make a conscious effort to look at our health, but we're getting the sleep that we need, the stress levels. It's amazing what stress can do to your body. It's just unbelievable. And when you find yourself working in an environment where you enjoy what you do, you enjoy your customers, you enjoy getting up every morning and facing those challenges head on with a smile on your face, it makes all the difference.
Brad, hang on there. John DeGraff, Dave Gould, what do you make of this turnaround? That's exactly what you're talking about, isn't it?
Nobody could say it better. That's great, Brad. And I'm going to tell you my email address, because I'd like your story. I'd like to be able to put your story in the Take Back Your Time newsletter. It's J as in John, O as in Over, D as in Dog, G as in George at Comcast.net. I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that the new Gallup studies of happiness have found, and this is a real kicker, is that out of 150 countries in the world surveyed, the U.S. ranks 145th in stress. That is, people in 144 countries express less stress than Americans do. The only countries that are worse are like Iraq and Afghanistan and places where people are at war. So what you say is absolutely correct with the evidence about health and everything else. Dave?
Well, the only thing I would add is I have a friend that has a wonderful phrase, because certainly what Brad is saying, and I also applaud you, Brad. There is a trimming back in our consumption that often goes with this equation. I have a friend that has the phrase that he uses and kind of lives by: small house equals large life. And this notion that that I live a rich, large life, and maybe don't quite have the three or four cars in the driveway and the plasma TVs and the kinds of things like that, but I choose a lifestyle that's richer and deeper. And I would encourage people to think of their lives in that way, about what at the end of the day is really important. What we know is that those kind of momentary pleasures, those consumer goods, really have no long-lasting happiness to us. Finding the things we intrinsically love to do, those signature strengths in our lives, they do have lasting. And then when you can take those signature strengths and you can use them for something that has meaning and purpose beyond yourself, into the community, into the world, that's kind of the highest level of the happiness that we can live as human beings.
Brad, thank you for your story from Ledora. And what's the name of your wine bar, by the way?
It's called the Ledora Bank Bistro. It's right in Ledora, a small town of about 230 people.
That's a wonderful story.
Very good. Brad, good luck. Continued good luck to you and your wife, and good health.
Thank you so much.
Happiness. Brad calling us from Ledora. Perhaps you have a story of when your life was out of balance. You got it back in balance. Tell us your story. We have a few minutes left. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And this email from Jim in Washington. Jim asks, can't technology play a major role in helping us strive for greater balance? We have the tools in place for machines to perform many of our common tasks. Yet, in my view, this technology race has complicated our lives even more. Jim in Washington. Yes, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it, John DeGraff and Dave Gould, this technology thing?
You know, it really is, and it's an ironic thing, because you would think logically that as we technologically become more advanced, and have these kind of things that make our lives kind of things move quicker, that they would benefit us and give us time for ourselves and time for our family and time for community. But in a lot of ways, and we live in a culture of speed, and so as these technological things kind of come along that we see in the horizon as being kind of as utopias, they end up becoming problems. I'll give you an example. When the washing machine came on, I mean, my grandmother used to wash her hands or clothes by hand. But when the washing machine came along, and you think that would save people like my grandmother so much time, it really hasn't. We now wash clothes twice as fast. We've made extra work for ourselves. Right. We need a quicker internet connection to be faster still. So in a way, it's been counterintuitive.
Wasn't it true, John DeGraff, I think you've written about this too, that some experts in the early 20th century, we go back about 100 years, we're predicting the problem most societies would have to face in the future was not overwork, but what people would do with all the free time created by technological advance and industrialization. Isn't that true?
Well, it certainly was especially true in the 1960s when I first was connected with that. A U.S. Senate subcommittee in 1965, for instance, predicted that by the year 2000, Americans would be working 15 to 20 hours a week, and they would have 7 to 10 weeks of vacation time, and so much time in their hands they wouldn't know what to do with it.
So how is this vision faulty?
Well, the fact is we keep filling things up. We don't think about, this other side of what's important to life, which is the social connection and the doing things that are meaningful and the sharing and the generosity and involvement in the community, all the things that Dave's talking about. We simply try to get more and more out of it. And, I think what we have done. As long as we believe that we endlessly need more and more stuff, then we're going to use these time savers and all of this just to try to do more and more to bring us in those directions. We've got to turn that around. Tonight, I think, listeners, if you can come to the Iowa Memorial Union and hear Juliet Shore speak at 7:30. She's going to be talking about a different kind of society in which we do use these technologies, but we use them to give ourselves more time, to give ourselves a different kind of life with more time for families and gardening and local activities and community. I think it'll be well worth your coming.
And more information about the symposium, if you just put your search machine on Balanced Lives, Best Policies for the New Economy is a good way to find it, I found, unless you two had a different way for people seeking more information.
Oh, that's good. It's in the university's Public Policy Center is who's hosting it. So that's also their website will also direct you there, the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center.
Okay, let's try to squeeze in a call or two more. Robert is in Mason City. He's been listening to the conversation. Did you change your life? Were you out of balance at one point, Robert?
Yes, I took early retirement from a job as a school psychologist, which is a very high-stress job. And I got a pension, which is about half of what my salary was, but life is way sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
And my health is better. Stress levels are virtually gone.
Mm-hmm. So how did you change your life? What do you do today that makes you happy, more fulfilled?
Oh, well, I was also a part-time musician, which I'm doing now pretty much all my free time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like living my dream, basically.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessary. It's just that you didn't, the satisfaction you had from your job wasn't there. You didn't get up every day and look forward to it, or what?
Yeah, I had some job satisfaction, but it was mixed with high stress levels, very high stress, and demands and deadlines and, the whole bit.
And you say your health has improved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, joint pain is way less. I mean, I had osteoarthritis, and the joint pain is way less. I used to have stomach aches all the time. Those went away.
Robert.
Sleeping better. I mean, just all kinds of things.
Robert, thank you for sharing your story from Mason City. Let's go to this email quickly before we have to leave for the hour. This is Faraz. Emailing us. He says, I think that being overworked is definitely a valid metric to measure against happiness. However, being underworked is equally damaging. There was a recent paper that addressed results from an 18-year-long happiness study that points to this conclusion at one point. What about cognitive surplus? Personally, I feel like there are so many projects that I would like to have to take on but don't have the time to do it. We have about a minute or so left. John and Dave, any closing words, a reaction to Faraz?
Well, I'd certainly like to agree that being underworked and not having sufficient jobs and things is just as bad. It can be often worse for people. Being unemployed is certainly not good for you. But what that tells me is not that we should trying to get back to an economy where we have everybody working 50, 60, 70 hours a week and so forth. But what we should do to try to solve unemployment in this country is really to share the work, reduce the working hours so that everybody has a chance to work, but to work reasonable hours and to get to have a decent chance for balance in their lives.
Okay. Dave, any closing words?
Well, I would add the term of the book that Jody wrote, the notion of raising the floor. We do need to be thinking not only of those that are working too much, but about those that aren't working enough, and raising the floor to them so that things like sick time and vacation time are standard things in our country. A single mom should not be having to go and waitress at a restaurant with, let's say, a fever because she has no sick time that she can take. She should not be put in that type of situation, and we need to watch out for those people very much.
Dave Gould, John DeGraff, thank you very much for sharing your ideas this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. I want to thank all those who emailed and called today with their stories of balanced and unbalanced lives. It was an enjoyable conversation. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.